Hello and welcome to the Tech on Toast podcast. I'm Chris Fletcher, presenter and editor of Tech on Toast. Today we'll be kicking off our focus series of episodes dedicated to fueling business growth through innovative, accessible technology. To help navigate this topic across the year, Tech on Toast is teaming up with our friends at Dojo, a payments provider dedicated to empowering businesses as they grow and scale to new heights. Each week, you'll hear from an industry professional and Dojo expert who will unlock key insights and provide actionable takeaways that'll help you discover new innovations within the market, understand key business challenges, and most importantly, learn how to solve them. Enjoy the show. Good morning, everybody. Welcome to my little corner of the world today and the TechX stage. My name's Chris Fletcher. I'm the founder and CEO of something called Tech on Toast. We help you simplify the way you buy and manage your hospitality tech. And joining me today, I've got two lovely people who I've known for years and this one I've met today. So, guys, can you just introduce yourself before we talk what we're talking about? We'll start with you, Guy.
Yeah, sure. I'm Guy Scott South. I'm the IT director for Pizza Hut Restaurants. We're called the Heart of Smart Group because we also run Sir Mitsu's as well, but we're a big franchise operator. I've worked in restaurants for over 20 years, doing various roles, starting in ops and then moving into IT. So great opportunity to have a little chat today about technology.
My name's Chris Jolliffe. I'm the head of enterprise at Dojo. I've been in the hospitality space now for around a decade, most of that time selling software as a service into hospitality operators. And then prior to that, working in the trenches with you guys.
We're talking today about rebuilding your tech stack or looking at a fractured tech stack. And I suppose when you're on these conversations, we're talking a lot to operators at the moment. We do what we call a tech stack light, where we go and do a small drawing of their tech stack so they can visualize what they've got. And we always come across the conversation all-in-one versus best-in-class. And I'd love to understand, I suppose, from Pizza Hut's point of view and your own personal point of view, where you sit on that conversation, what you actually think it means. And then the same for you, Chris, once Guy's finished.
I think for a business like ours, we've been operating restaurants since 1978 in the UK. So it's this nice ideal of having an all-in-one solution. But the reality is we have systems from 20 years ago, 25 years ago, and then modern systems have been brought in as well. So there's a huge amount of technical debt in the organization, which makes it very challenging to move away into one nice solution. So for us, and given that we've got central resource, generally we have a bit of a mixed bag, and we try to look for best of breed in different areas. Then, of course, have the challenge of trying to integrate all of those as well. So it doesn't come without its challenges.
And we were talking before about a business case. So, if you want to change POLs or if you want to change workforce management, I suppose you've got to prove to someone that A, it's worth doing, and B, there'll be an ROI on it, and C, that operations can handle that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, operators in restaurants don't particularly like change. They get used to doing things. Technology isn't necessarily core to what most restaurants do. We're selling food, we're making food. Technology can help, but the operators themselves tend to not want to move away from what they know because it's a distraction from the core part of the business.
Yep. Any operators in the room would agree with that, I think. What about you, Chris? I know, just to explain a bit, so you were previously with Cobas prior to Dojo, and now you're at Dojo doing your thing. But what have you come across in terms of that conversation?
Yes, as you mentioned there, I've fortunately been in a position where I've sold the best of breed products working for Tavalis for 7.5 years. And then sold the all-in-one solution when I was working with Cobas. And obviously now I'm working with Dojo, selling the best-in-class in payments. So I've seen it from all those different angles. And fortunately or unfortunately for Guy, I've been on his coattails for about 5 years, and we're now finally working together with Dojo. But from my perspective, it depends on the buyer. It depends on what their requirements are and where that true value proposition is when they're looking to acquire tech. So there is a marketplace for the best in breed, because you may have testaments or referenceability in the integrations that you can offer that suit the major requirements for that operator. But then similarly, I think from a buyer's perspective, sometimes it's easier buying all-in-one because it's seen as, oh, there's this holy grail of everything that I need and it's all there and I can just pay one invoice and it's done. I don't have to do this project anymore because of that upheaval in operations, because it takes time to buy tech. So I think me personally, I do prefer the best in breed approach. I think it's harder. I think it takes a lot longer to embed a solution, but it does ultimately give you a better end product. Whereas the all-in-one does have a definite place in the market for different size operators.
Just on that point, I think it's a really good point about central teams not wanting to change as well. They're going through the process of changing a POS supplier. The payment supplier is a bit lighter, but these big technology companies, it's months and months of work to get it right. There's negotiation, there's contracts, and actually I think that's the reason lots of people stay with the same technology for a long time. Our POS system is 20 years old now.
You're making all these people sad over here, but yeah.
I know, it's difficult.
No, but it's true. You know, people like me go and talk about A-B testing and, you know, just do it in one site, just give it a go, try one location and roll out. But as you say, you talk, we won't mention the cost, but you mentioned what you were paying before in terms of for your POS provider. It's actually, you know, you're in a good deal.
Yes.
And actually operations are coping and things are okay. So the passion from your side to do a change like that is minimal.
It is, yeah. It's really difficult until you get to a point where it's the risk of maintaining that old technology becomes too great. But it's quite challenging sometimes having that conversation with boards about what the cost of the risk is versus the moving forward and the cost of the new technology and implementation. Yeah. It's so difficult, right?
I think you're making it up. But what kind of questions, I suppose, should operators be asking? So if there's someone, you know, if we've got a lovely salesperson sitting in our room selling us the dream for a new workforce management or new guest experience or new payments, what kind of questions should an operator be asking? I'll start with you, I suppose, Chris, because you've sat in a lot of these conversations, to actually make sure they're getting the best out of A, that deal, and B, what they're looking down the road at.
Yeah, I think it's really important. I mean, it's weird that I'm communicating in this way, but I suppose from my perspective, we always try and take the buyer on a fulfilled journey. You can sell to anybody ultimately, but if you're not fulfilling what that prospect requires, then you're not doing your job properly, and ultimately you'll get found out later down the line. So from my perspective, it's truly understanding the why. Why are we here? What are you wanting from this interaction? What do you want that output to be? And then obviously it's a salesperson's job to demonstrate that can be fulfilled by the product that you have. And I think it's really important from a buyer's perspective to interrogate that, to go, okay, you say that it could do that. What does that mean? Because your perception of fulfillment might be different to the product that they're offering. So getting down to the nitty-gritty, which does take time and it is arduous, is fundamentally important. And it's important for the seller, because otherwise you're going to end up having a bad relationship down the line. But it's really important for the buyer, because if you get it right, it makes you look good and it makes you have the product that you need straight off the bat. And look, if it isn't a right fit for us in particular, we'll walk away, because we might have that product later, we might have a better fit later, and ultimately, everyone's on a bit of a merry-go-round anyway. If you provide the best products and service, you're going to get a customer and retain them for longer, whereas other customers will become apparent from other suppliers that you're losing to. So, yeah.
Yeah, I think to pick up on that as well, I think it's really important to get your requirements from across the organization very clear before you go into the process of looking at what the vendors can fulfill them. I think sometimes people forget about the requirements of someone in the finance team or a particular stakeholder who isn't necessarily core to the project, and it can come back to bite you later. So being really clear on what the requirements are, making sure everyone who might need to be involved is involved. And then, as Chris said, really interrogating the salespeople when they promise that they can deliver on your requirements, because I don't know how many times I've been through it where you go through a sales process and people will say, yes, we can do that, we can do that. It's on our roadmap, it's a classic one, right? And, you know, I'd always say, if there are too many things that are on the roadmap, just have a serious think about whether the product's going to deliver what you want, because sales guys like to say this because it lures you in where there's a gap from your expectation. But we've found several situations in the past where we've had to pull out of the process because they haven't been able to deliver on what they've said. And that's no good for anyone. It's a huge amount of wasted time for both parties.
Yeah, no, exactly. And that just mirrors kind of what I was saying at the beginning, is that it is important for both sides. You can't win everything. You just physically can't. And everyone's product's different. Everyone's requirement is niche. Every operator in here will have a different go-to-market strategy, which requires different tech to sit behind it. And there's not everybody can fit those needs.
And I think I spoke to William Connors, who's the CTO at Noble Group, on a stage about 3 years ago over there somewhere, and he said the way he summed this up was like, you've got the operator saying, I've got a problem, I've got a problem, I've got to fix it. Then you've got a salesperson saying, I've got a sale, I'm going to nail it. And then somewhere in the middle, it all goes wrong. And I think that's basically what you've been describing there, that there are two very different needs meeting together, and somewhere in the middle, and they need to match, and that doesn't always work. And Guy, when you are rolling tech out, and I know you haven't in 25 years, no, but you have in some form.
Yeah, we have.
What kind of steps are you taking before, so you've got your chosen product, you've done the interrogation on the salespeople, you're buying it in, you're onboarding. Okay, what are the kind of steps you take within Pizza Hut to make sure that you're following that through till the end and you don't have all these problems you discussed that might happen?
I think it's really key to have, and it might sound obvious, but clear project management on both sides so that there's a point of accountability. Projects that go really well tend to have a strong project manager on the business's side. We've just been through this with Dojo, and we've had great project management. It's really stood out. So, yeah, very good. That's a little pitch.
That's why he came.
No, but it makes a huge difference, actually, because you want to focus on carry on running the restaurant. You don't want all the challenges of implementation. So the good suppliers take all that pain away from you. And clearly, there's all the standard stuff of making sure that the training's fit for purpose for the operators. You keep disruption to a minimum. Stakeholders within the sort of above restaurant functions are kept on board throughout. I think that's pretty much it.
And I think on the project management side of things, that should start during the discovery phase of the commercial propositioning. All the time I say to my team, it's every engagement you have with the customer, you've got insights on what the project's going to be looking like. And you need to, at every stage of that process, be it the discovery, the proposal, the negotiations, or the contracting, you need to reiterate where we're at, what their expectations we believe they are, what give them the opportunity to layer in their expectations, and then start building that pack up as you go. And then by the time you get to the point where contract's signed off and it's negotiated, you can hand over a nice, sweet little package that we've all forgotten what we've actually discussed over to the implementations team so they can then drive that home and deliver what's ultimately needed. And that really does help when we're discussing things that we've discussed about in the past, or pipeline dreams, or whatever it might be. It's all catalogued. And I think it gives that, we discussed, didn't we, when I've known Guy for a long time now, and we said, look, how was the journey? Because I'm relatively new to Dojo, I'm only 10 months in, and he said, do you know what, it's been really good. You've been hand-holding me all the way through it. It's payments, but everything's been really clear, and what I'm getting, it makes sense. So,
just add to that. I think, you know, particularly in recent years, central teams are less resourced than ever before. Our team's a lot smaller than it was pre-pandemic. So, one of the main reasons people don't like to change is that it's a distraction from the day job running these projects. So, I think that's where it's really helpful to have that support from a supplier, because it lets you get on with everything else that you need to do. We don't have spare project managers generally. So it's taken from someone's day job in the organization to be able to do that.
And how does it work then in smaller business? I mean, this might be more for you when you were selling into smaller clients at Cobas, but because they don't have that. They don't have the luxury of a guy. They don't have a CTO, or they might not have an IT team even. They might have a lot of the people we work with at Tech on Toast are kind of 15 sites below, and they have an operations team or a CFO ends up dealing with this. How does it work for them in terms of hand-holding and making sure they get the same experience as the guy has?
So we call that the buyer-owner kind of relationship. The buyer, the owner, the administrator, the accounts, they're everything. And for us, that what they're looking for when they're acquiring products, unfortunately, is time-saving. They want to know that if they go with you, that particular supplier, are you going to get the system in on time? Is it going to be with the least friction as possible for them? And is it going to work?
Yeah.
And that's where, from my perspective, the referenceability is huge. Like whenever we are working with a prospect, we always say to our customers, look, I'm going to tell you what you want to hear, ultimately. I'm going to proposition this deck to what you want to hear. Speak to the customers we have that are a similar ilk to you, similar operational style to you, and get that feedback from them. That is the only truth that you're going to hear in terms of true raw feedback. How is the implementation? How is the ongoing support? And how is the product? And does it fit your needs and purpose? So I suppose, how do we do it? We tailor it, obviously, because they're at a different cost base. When you've got someone with 150 locations versus one location, there's a different cost in terms of implementation. And we just make it fit for purpose. But ultimately, the project team, like, they intrinsically know how to deal with that owner-operator versus how to deal with a conglomerate or a big corporate business. And that's something that's innate within the function, not necessarily within the product, if that makes sense.
No, it makes sense. And I think we did a survey last year at Tech on Toast, and 82% of operators who we surveyed said they would buy tech based on someone's reference. They'd come down here and have a browse, maybe they'd have a look around, but really they're buying off their mates. Is that kind of what your experience over the years?
Yeah, I think that's true. And you know, for a smaller organization, if you're doing everything running the business, you're like the ops manager for a small group, 5, 10, 15, you might not actually have the time to come down to one of these shows and do that. So really, if you've got a problem in the organization, I mean, the hospitality business is quite tight-knit and people move around within hospitality. So generally, if you've worked for a while in the business, you're going to know a whole host of people in different organizations who have used different pieces of software. So yeah, absolutely. I think word of mouth is the main way things get done.
And I actually think that the owner operator up to like the 15, 20 sites, that kind of operator model, they do heavily rely on referenceability to make a decision. They will. If their mate has it, they'll have it. But when you're talking more corporate kind of organizations, you'll get to the table at a reference. Yeah. There's no way you'll get the gig without having the substance. There's just no way.
Yeah, I mean, we tend to do a sort of a tender light process for all of our suppliers. It's not, you know, again, due to resource, it's not a massive formal tender process, but we will look at different people, usually based on recommendations, but then send our requirements out in RFP and go from there.
It's interesting. This question isn't in the deck. Sorry, guys. But just because you mentioned change a couple of times, yeah. and we've got a session on change, being change ready tomorrow. Do you think in the future that we'll see more project managers, more change ready specialists sitting in larger brands and enterprise brands where they are able to take on I know that's your role. I'm not making you redundant. but those kind of roles, do you think they'll start appearing more in hospitality businesses?
Yeah, I mean, I can only speak for us. You know, I've been with Pizza Hut for 20 years now, so my experience is somewhat limited to that. But, I think that, generally speaking, there aren't enough change programs within our IT department to justify having full-time project managers. I think if you can get generalists who understand technology and understand operations, can work across the organization, I think that role is becoming more and more useful.
Yeah. Yeah. What do you think, Chris?
Yes. Yeah, I do. I think we're seeing massive consolidation of staffing with more corporate kind of organisations. We don't have the manpower that they once used to have. Bodies are being accounted for as to why they need to be there. And like you've mentioned, the change programme for a project manager in IT just doesn't warrant a full-time kind of role. So I think there will be a lot more third parties that are consulting on operational change, tech change, that kind of stuff, with a view of then working with them. And I think you'll see a shift between there'll be a more consultative approach to buying, but ultimately the decision will lay with the people that are embedded within the business. So yes.
Yeah, for sure. And we wanted to move to data while we've got some time left. Sure. And You mentioned the legacy tech that you're involved in, but I'm guessing you're still getting lots of data from that stack. And you mentioned that you were trialing kiosks in certain locations recently. How is data now driving Pizza Hut, I suppose, as you move forward into this new digital era?
We've actually had a pretty well-established data warehouse for the best part of 20 years, and I know some brands don't. It is quite old now, and we're in the process of modernizing that, so that's been a big project for us. But you're right, yes, there's lots of data coming from all sources. We've got our mobile ordering, bring-your-own-device style ordering, we've got kiosks, we've got web. And the challenge now is creating a single customer view where we don't necessarily have a sort of logged in journey for everyone. So it's getting the information that we can, and that might include some payment information down the line. We're working with Chris to understand how we can use that information to better understand customers. But it drives everything that we do. When we do tests in different restaurants for new menu, or we do pricing tests, we need to be able to analyze that accurate data from the POS system and kiosk, etc.
And we were at your head office the other day meeting your founders, which is really cool. Thank you. And they were talking about the heart behind what you guys do, in fact, that data is driving everything, and that, and there's a thirst for it now from the operators that actually that we need this data to help us make better decisions on smaller resource teams. Is that what you're, are you enabling that now for these people?
Yeah, I mean, look, I personally believe that data within our industry is heavily underutilized. I think we sit on lots of data, lots of insights, lots of really valuable stuff. We don't share it. We lose it when we change POS providers. And ultimately, we don't benefit from having all that information, which is, it's, when you look at it, it's quite nuts, really. But in terms of, from Dojo's perspective, we're doing the whole empowering the experience economy. So essentially, we're connecting the dots between trying to entice your customers into the restaurant, give them a hassle-free or invisible payment experience, make sure that they enjoy that experience, be it in the venue and obviously from the payments perspective, and then and then trying to bring them back around. So I think from Dojo's perspective, you're going to see a massive data play within the CRM, the payments and tokenization, and then bringing all that back around to create that flywheel effect. That's going to come sooner than you think, if I'm honest with you. Because when you're in a position like ours, where 1 in 8 transactions in the high street goes through one of our terminals, you're in a really powerful position, and you can harness that power and give that back to you guys, the operators, not just for what you're doing, but from a global picture as well. So it'll be quite nice.
I think you know, one of the challenges we talked about, best in breed versus sort of an all-in-one solution. So data's really important here, and we've got lots of different suppliers, and as I said, we've got our own data warehouse. It's amazing how many suppliers are still sort of dumping flat files onto FTP servers rather than having a modern data transfer approach. So, you know, I think there's lots of catching up to do in the industry. You see lots of products that look really shiny on the front end, and they've spent a lot of money getting the front end right. And this isn't about you, Chris. You know, you guys are working with us. But, you know, there are lots of companies where you think they're tech-based, but what's lying behind that, if you want to get the data, is really quite old and quite challenging to use. And then you build a lot of technical debt. You have this transfer of files, daily files. You may miss one occasionally, and then you're chasing up to try and find it. So I think there's a lot of work to do still in data.
100%.
And I think that comes onto the value proposition, because we don't see value in it right now. It's not front and center of a lot of tech companies. That's ultimately what it is.
Yeah, it's quite marketing heavy. You're talking about the approach to the vendors potentially have a marketing heavy, yeah. As you said, look great. And then when you dig a bit deeper, some of the style isn't there. And I was talking to an operator the other day. They've got 25 sites. They are having to do manual downloads from 6 different systems daily. Yeah. And their payroll actually required 3 different downloads from 3 different sources on a weekly and monthly basis, which is, you know, and you just think, and that's human error then getting involved as well as the tech. So I think there's a lot of untangling to do still.
The thing is, a pain like that, though, that's where an all-in-one would benefit nicely from, because that pain is insurmountable.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I called it the Shirley syndrome. So we had a prime minister. I was on the board at prime minister. We had a lady called Shirley who used to do all our payroll for us every week. She was amazing, but she really struggled with the data. Like, she really struggled downloading it, made a lot of errors, not through her fault, just because she's not a data processor. So she's handling all this data, and I think I would say the 20% of these brands, hospitality operators, have a Shirley in their office potentially doing that download every day, potentially making errors on people's pay, which
Absolutely.
Is the single most important thing you can do, right?
Yeah, it's really easy to do as well, and there's been a move over the past 5 or 10 years to try and automate more of finance, but most big legacy finance departments are still quite backwards when it comes to data management. And
Carluccio's, I think our finance department was bigger than our ops team at one point. So
yeah,
I always had a problem with that. Anyway,
they get a bigger budget though, don't they?
They do. They get a bigger budget. It's because we do all the hard work. Anyway, I just want to talk about Chris. Actually, from your point of view, what is the tech? There's a lot of tech vendors here today. There's a lot of operators hopefully wandering around as well. What's the responsibility on your side? And we touched on a little bit about your relationship in terms of delivery. But what is the tech vendor's responsibility when it comes to selling in and onboarding and making sure that actually what you said they'd get, they're going to get?
Yeah, it's what I mentioned, what I touched on earlier, to be honest with you. It's taking that prospect through that journey. Everyone has targets. Everyone wants to grow. Everyone wants business. But you've got to get the right customer. And at any point in time, not every customer is right for your business at that point in time. You might not have the software for it. They might be too big for you. They might be too small for you. But ultimately, if at every stage of that process while you're going through that acquisition, you're setting that expectation, you're documenting what's been spoken about, what you need from them, what they need from you, and you're taking through that journey, you'll be in a position at the end of it where everyone has a clear understanding of what needs to be delivered and what will be delivered. And then you'll start that relationship off in the right process. Similarly, if you go through that process and you get to a dead end and you go, well, actually, we're at a crossroads now. We can't do what you need and we can't give you what you want. And part ways, because I guarantee you, if you do it like that, you're going to have a really good lasting impression on that buyer and they will come back knocking, or they will entertain you when you go knocking to them later down the line with that solution to that problem.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. You know, if you get to the point where that happens and both parties end up falling back on the contract, it just ends up in a no-win situation unless you're a lawyer, right? So, yeah. You know, that's the reality of it. So I think that's a very grown-up approach that not all vendors take. You don't want to be stuck with a relationship that isn't working for either party. And, you know, there may be some short-term gains in terms of money, but reputationally, it's quite damaging. We talk about it being a small industry. If you treat people badly, you do get found out in the long run.
So very quickly, what does the future hold for pizza, the near future, I suppose?
So we're investing more in kiosks, as you mentioned before. At the start of the pandemic, we introduced digital ordering through the phone for the first time, and we've maintained about 60% of people still ordering that way, and for a lot of customers, it relieves those pain points of, you know, waiting to find a waiter, wanting to order a second beer, wanting to pay your bill at the end. So for a lot of people, that was really beneficial. We still found that those people who didn't want to use their phones were more likely to engage with kiosks, because you can use a traditional card to pay on it if you want to. It's a bigger screen. It's fun for children as well. We're still a very children-focused brand. So that's definitely the future. You know, rising costs of labor, it's gone at, what, 10-11% this year it's going to come up.
Sure, that'll get mentioned in the next few days here, but yeah.
You know, it's a reality. You know, margins are already wafer thin in the industry, and we are having to find ways to introduce technology that removes waste from the system while allowing us to focus on the things that are really important. So making sure that the servers that we have left are really focused on the real hospitality bits, you know, the greeting, the checking in, the having a nice conversation with people. We don't want to lose that with technology. We need to find a nice symbiosis.
Yeah, and I was in Russell Square the other night on a random night, and I was at Pizza Hut, which I haven't been in years, and it was great. So you've got 60 seconds, my friend, to tell us all about Dojo. Go.
So I think from our point of view, we're getting into the enterprise world quite heavily now. We've dominated the SME space for quite some time. Got a lot of market share there. We're currently at about 11% market share in the enterprise space right now. By the end of this year, we'll be reaching 25% of that market share. But we're going to be doing that as a product-led organization, delivering the right products so that people can afford and get our products, essentially.
But thank you very much. Appreciate you all being here in the back row there. Hello, everyone. But thanks for coming. If you've got any questions, I think you can grab our panelists. They'll hang around here for a minute if you want to have a quick chat to them. And we'll see you later. We'll be back at 2:00 with the loyalty people. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for joining us today. I really hope you enjoyed our first of our series collaboration with Dojo. As a payments platform designed for the experience economy, Dojo helps businesses increase efficiency and improve customer experience. If you're curious about growing your business with a robust, reliable, and resilient payments platform, head to the dojo.tech website now. Tune into the rest of our series for even more insights from our Dojo experts and industry guests, all designed to empower you in taking your business to the next level. See you soon.